Hey everybody, welcome again to F This Movie. My name is Patrick Bromley, and I'm joined today for a discussion of Dawn of the Planet of the Apes by the damn dirtiest ape I know, JB.
And the scariest thing about me is that I don't need electricity, and I don't need the lights.
We're going to be talking Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, which is just out in theaters this weekend. We will talk spoiler-free for a few minutes, as is our way when we do new release movies, and then we'll get into spoilers, but you can certainly stick around and listen to our initial thoughts of the movie, a recommendation, if that's what you're looking for.
And then I'm going to spoil the shit out of it.
No, that's fine. But you can visit our website at fthismovie.net. You should follow us on Twitter. We're at fthismovie. You can like our page on Facebook, or you can email us at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com. We're available in the iTunes store. If you like the show and you have a few seconds, you want to leave a review for us, hopefully positive, that would be great. Every little bit helps, and thanks to everybody who's taken the time to do that. To find all of our past episodes, we've gotten a few tweets lately and messages, people saying, hey, I want to listen to your show, but I only can hear this many. Go to fthismovie.net. There's a podcast tab at the back. It goes back 4 years. We have over 220 shows, I would say.
Yeah, recently there was a tweet from someone. I'm just going to say they were from Buenos Aires. I don't think they were. But it was another one of those just discovered your show,
yeah,
and they had been clicking around and listening, and that makes us happy.
Yeah, those are great.
So few things lately make us happy.
Jay Bones, before we start talking Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, which I will most assuredly refer to more than once on this podcast as Rise of the Planet of the Apes because I can't keep it straight, have you seen anything good lately?
Yes, and you touched upon this last week, and I just have to say that the reaction to your review last week was very interesting because I, too, saw Snowpiercer.
Yeah, you did.
You will not see a better movie all year.
Says me. A bunch of people say otherwise.
And I obviously, this is subjective, and perhaps their opinion is the right opinion as opposed to our opinion. But I had a problem with people who couldn't accept the premise.
Sure.
And
which could be said of any movie ever.
True.
Right.
And this is something we're going to talk about later with Dawn of the Planet of the Apes.
Apes don't talk.
The ability of... I shudder to think that we've gotten to the point where people only go to movies to understand the story by what's going on the screen, and they have lost the ability, maybe willingly, because I'm here to have fun and I'm not here to think, I'm here to enjoy this movie, that people have lost the ability to see the film metaphorically or as an analogy, because Snowpiercer has a lot to say about a lot of things,
and
not all of them are about poor people on a train.
Right, I totally agree with that. I think a lot of people, a lot of the blowback or the negative reaction I've seen, you know, not on our site necessarily, but elsewhere, people talking about the movie on Facebook or in comments for other reviews on other sites, a lot of people took issue with the fact that the metaphor, the sort of central metaphor of the movie, is too blunt and obvious, which wasn't an issue for me, and it has nothing to do with my own politics, because I actually think the movie arrives at some conclusions that don't necessarily support the ideology that everybody thinks it supports.
Oh, no. And I think when you get to the end, perhaps because Ed Harris's monologue is a little on the nose,
right,
I think people are ignoring that it's far more ambiguous and embracing of different positions than some people are accepting. And again, now we're playing this dance around
right,
the mulberry
right,
bush
right,
because we don't want to spoil anything. But the people who say, well, if you're trying to say something about poverty, why did you show us a lot of poor people? What, do you want them to be mice?
I don't know. I think they're reducing the movie to poor people good, rich people bad, which is not what the movie is.
No, that's
at
not.
All.
No, there's a lot of gradations in between. And I think some people are willingly forgetting a sort of late in the game plot twist, really, that sort of sends the whole film spinning
right
around again. I don't understand people who bemoan how absolutely shitty most movies are, and then won't embrace this. Farachi tweeted last week, anyone who tries to convince you not to see Snowpiercer is the devil.
It's really ambitious, and it is messy, which is another word I keep seeing thrown around as though that's a pejorative, but that's part of what I like about
it. The messiness of it is something I really like. Chris Evans, completely different than any Chris Evans we've ever seen. Again, the people who are, you know, sort of shitting on it, Snowpiercer, he says, holding out his left hand, Tammy.
Right. I haven't seen Tammy, so I can't.
Neither, and I won't.
I probably won't either, but I don't want to bash it having not seen it.
It's a comic gem.
It's fine if people don't like it. It really is.
From the people who brought you shitting in the sink.
It's fine to not like it. I just don't like the reaction. I don't like any reaction, really, that's like, you're wrong, it's not good. Like, well, no, you didn't like it, and that's fine, but I think it's a masterpiece, and I'm going to hold on to that belief, even if you say that I'm incorrect. I'm amazed that there's been that much. I didn't think this movie would be that polarizing. Like, it's fine if you don't like it, but at least just be like, it's not for me, instead of trying to convince me that it's a bad movie, which you will never do.
And even if you didn't like it,
right,
and you have that right,
right,
will you at least admit that on several levels, it is head and shoulders above the cattle feed that we're usually given in the summer?
Absolutely. And maybe it's just maybe people feel like it's being overhyped, and so this is their response. I don't
know. Yes, it's being overhyped at the three theaters and video on demand.
It is available on video on demand if you don't already know that, and a lot of people have been tweeting about it and writing about it, the fact that you can see it. But if you haven't yet, do it. It's on demand on Amazon, on iTunes. Check it out.
And oddly enough, as my wife pointed out, in the little area that we live, it's now at the theater where you can eat.
Yeah. Oh, it is?
And I thought, well, I like to eat,
and
I'd like to see the movie again. So I might just head over there this week.
It deserves to be seen on a big screen if you can.
With fancy pretzels.
Always with fancy pretzels.
The other film...
That was your band in high school, right? That's a callback to a joke made before we started recording, everyone.
Before we started recording. I know you saw this the other night on VOD, and I saw it the other night on VOD, though a different night. And I was so happy that I finally got to see it because, my God, Life Itself.
Yes.
The new Steve James documentary. And I really liked it and went in sort of negative because I was afraid that in the waning days of Ebert's life, that he was sort of being this opportunist. But he obviously had Ebert's full cooperation. That this is something that Ebert wanted to do for a reason that's elucidated in the film.
Yeah, which I didn't know.
It's really terrific. And the more I think about it, the more I'm impressed by its structure. I had read the book. I think the film is actually better than the book.
I would agree with that.
And it just reminded me, brief autobiographical pause, that one of the measures of Ebert's greatness was the different ways in which he touched a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
It seems in the days following his passing, everyone had their Ebert story. Either I went to Ebert Fest for years and years and years and years and really enjoyed it. But what I most remembered watching the film was my father worked for the Chicago Sun-Times for 35 years. And one of the perks of that job was he would get the early edition the night before.
Mm.
So every
Telling the future.
Well, yeah, literally. Because every Thursday night, Dad would come home with the Friday edition of the Sun-Times, which would A, let me read Ebert's review a couple hours early, and B, and I think I've talked about this, I could plan out the weekend because I'd have the show times. This was pre-internet. And I would think there were a bunch of reasons that got into me studying film in college and then becoming a film teacher. But I'd have to say that Ebert was probably one of them.
Me too, for sure.
Early influences.
I liked the movie a lot. Let me ask you this. If you and I were not such big fans of Roger Ebert, would we like the movie as much? Is this a movie that works for somebody who doesn't care about Ebert or maybe even movies?
I'd like to think that it would, because both in his struggle with his medical problems, which is kind of a framing device for the entire film, I found that very moving. I also found parts of it really hard to watch.
Yeah.
I think it was an interesting decision that we pretty much start with that procedure that is sort of hard to watch. Yeah. And then Ebert types out, "You've captured it, Steve. Suction." But also the way the film is so good at showing us the range of a man's life.
Yeah.
Just where he started and what he became and what he could have become had he not made the decision. It's amazing. And I would argue it's worth seeing for the photograph of Gene Siskel at the Playboy Mansion.
Oh, right.
In a pool.
I didn't know any of that.
With topless cuties.
Yeah.
And, you know, I grew up with Siskel and it's like, oh, wow.
That he used to like pal around with Hugh Hefner for a while.
Yeah. Like on the plane and stuff.
I had no idea.
So that was incredible. And I'd like to think that if you know nothing about Ebert, the film itself would hold your attention, and it's certainly worth your time. Steve James is an amazing documentarian.
He
really knows what he's doing.
Yeah. I got really bummed out because last week I was reading some tweets from a writer whose writing I tend to like, and yet who as a person I find more and more problematic or possibly despicable, who was devoting a lot of time to shitting all over Roger Ebert and calling him middle brow and safe, and he wrote for Moms, and Pauline Kael is a more dynamic writer, and that's fine if you want to prefer Pauline Kael to Roger Ebert, that is certainly your right. But I don't feel like to like Pauline Kael means to discount so much of what Roger Ebert did. And I had seen these tweets before watching the movie, and then I'm watching the movie, and hearing filmmakers talk about like, oh, I only have a career because Roger Ebert made it a point to keep beating the drum for me. I mean, Steve James could say the same thing, even though he didn't include any of that in the movie. But I mean, people knew of Hoop Dreams because of Roger Ebert.
And that's sort of the unspoken thing.
But to see him championing Bonnie and Clyde at a time when
no one.
Right.
Was.
Bosley Crowther was shitting all over, you know, I don't think. He's referred to in the movie as being a populist because he felt like everyone should understand a good movie. But that
I think that's dismissive because while I too grew up on Pauline Kael and obviously reading her work in those compendiums because I didn't subscribe to the magazine, and she is an expert stylist and a wonderful film critic, one of the best. I don't think Ebert was writing for Moms.
No.
I think Ebert was every bit the stylist, and I would actually argue
it was just a different style.
That Ebert was more consistent in that you always felt he was giving you your honest reaction, and I think there were occasions when Pauline Kael wasn't completely honest in that she was reacting against a fad or she was championing someone.
Sure.
I often thought there were hidden agendas. In fact, one of the most heartwarming parts of the Ebert documentary, which you just reminded me of, is when they show the filmmaker who made Man Push Cart and how huge Roger's endorsement was, because the first time I saw that film was at Ebert Fest, and it's an incredible film, but the sequence when Ebert gives him that gift.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's just...
Yeah, I mean, obviously, if you are listening to this, you're somebody who likes movies and probably are familiar with the work of Roger Ebert, but I feel like the movie can be enjoyed, appreciated, admired just as a story of the human condition, sort of.
Yes.
Because it very much looks at a guy from a lot of different sides, and it doesn't just deify Roger Ebert. I don't think it's a movie made about a critic just for film critics that celebrates, oh, aren't we wonderful? Because there are a lot of critics who are interviewed who kind of don't like, you know, what Roger Ebert quote unquote did to film criticism, even though I feel like that's unfair because even he was outspoken about this thumb idea that it was something that was dictated to him by somebody higher up and they had to do that. But he wasn't crazy about thumbs up, thumbs down, but everyone accuses him of just reducing art to good or bad. So I do feel like it does look, I don't think it's a movie just made to suck off film critics at all.
No, not at all. On a completely different note, Lately, in our neighborhood, there has been a surplus of classic film screenings.
Yeah.
So last week, you and Eric talked about Willy Wonka.
Yeah.
And courtesy of this classic thing, I got to see Willy Wonka on the big screen last Sunday and discovered that one theater near our house charges $6 for those, and the other theater that I will not be returning to charges $9.25.
For real?
So did you not get the telegram? And yeah, obviously, right. I have $3.25, but I rankled. And then the Elk Grove Theater continued their series from the Chicago Film Critics Association, and last Tuesday, I enjoyed Jaws with our very own Adam Riske,
yeah,
and once again saw that that film just plays and plays and plays. There was lots of people in the audience who had never seen it.
Really?
The critic who introduced the film asked for a show of hands, so it was amazing.
Yeah, that's fun. Holy cow. See.
Yeah, and afterwards, I think people stayed for about 40 minutes and had a really interesting conversation about what Jaws provides that modern films have forgotten about.
Interesting.
Why is it that Jaws works?
Yeah.
And it basically came down to that there's a real sense of adventure,
okay,
and danger, but that it's rooted in characters who we really get to know. We know who these three guys are. So it's not three video game mechs,
right,
and we don't care which one of them gets knocked off the boat by a shark.
Well, what Jaws does, from a larger perspective, is very easy to do in terms of if you want to make a successful summer blockbuster, do A, B, C, and D like Jaws. Like,
yeah,
you can do that fairly easy. Now, to do it as well as Jaws obviously is very complicated, so I'm not saying it's easy to make Jaws, but yeah, to have human characters that you care about and to know how to sort of pace your action scenes, or you know, the big reveals. Like, there are certain things that you could follow fairly easily. Again, you can't make Jaws easily, but
just ask the makers of Jaws 2, Jeanette Swark.
I don't think I've ever seen Jaws 2, by the way.
It's
I've seen 3 and 4, not for 20 years, but I don't think I've ever seen 2.
I remember going to Jaws 2.
Yeah.
And you have no idea, because this was before people knew that sequels were crappy.
Right.
Oh, the excitement.
Another Jaws.
They're just going to have the shark again. And then courtesy
is
of
it,
the...
I'm sorry, I don't mean to keep... Yeah. Is it a different shark? What's the deal? A different Jaws?
Clearly it has to be.
Yeah.
But I think at some point it's suggested that it's going after Brody's family or something.
That's in the fourth one, I think.
This time it's...
Yeah.
Jaws that, like, the Revenge.
Yeah, that the shark... No, whatever.
And then courtesy of the fine people at G-Fest, we are so lucky to have G-Fest in our backyard. They rented out a local theater called The Pickwick, which oddly enough used to be in the opening of one of the Siskel and Ebert shows. They showed them outside The Pickwick because it's an old movie palace. Thursday afternoon, they showed the 1976 John Guillermin King Kong. So I got to see that on a big screen.
Nice.
For the first time since 76.
Was it a video projection? Please tell me it was.
Let me think.
It will kill me if you tell me it was 35 millimeter.
I think it was a print.
Okay. God damn it.
I really think it was a print. And
I could not go and would love to have seen a 35 millimeter print. That's the King Kong I grew up on.
Once again, I got to compare 52-year-old JB with 14-year-old JB. And that movie's not very good.
It is really not. And that Me TV, that whole family of channels, like a month ago, they were showing it on all of their different iterations. And every time it was on, I would leave it on. It is really not good, but I left it on every single time.
The audience I saw it with really had a good time laughing at Charles Grodin's mustache twirling performance.
Jessica Lange's performance is an embarrassment.
I was impressed by how well Jeff Bridges acquits himself.
If not for the beard, yeah,
that he's pretty good in everything. But and say what you want, you know, we could rail against CGI. We are now so spoiled by excellent special effects, which we're going to talk about in terms of Dawn, that some of the special effects in King Kong, it's just odd that the 32 version, the 33 version, does it better.
Right.
The scene where Kong knocks everyone off the log, mm-hmm, and Jeff Bridges is hiding in that little alcove and Kong reaches down. I mean, literally, it looks like someone cut out an index card,
yeah,
and placed it in the set, and then they're projecting. I mean, it's really it doesn't match at all.
And again, the whole appeal was supposed to be that it was state of the art at the time. And wasn't Dino De Laurentiis trying to convince them?
There was so much bullshit about this. De Laurentiis convinced people that he had built a robot that can act. Because the minute the film is over...
And that wouldn't happen until Jessica Alba.
At the end of the film, there's this crazy, methinks he doth protest too much disclaimer. It's the first title that comes up after we pull back and the music swells. The producers would like to reiterate that Kong was built by Carlo Rambaldi and this other guy with the assistance of Rick Baker.
Right.
Winkety wink. Because there's actually three shots in the film of the robot. They did build one.
Yeah.
And it's tall and big and impressive. But the robot couldn't do shit.
Right.
So we have this long shot of Kong in the cage at the end.
Mm-hmm.
And it looks like something that milk, like chocolate milk came in that they sold it to kids. It's like a novelty.
Right.
Chocolate milk bottle. It's so immobile. And
it
then
looks like something chocolate milk came in.
Like a child's novelty giveaway for Kong. And then they cut to the close-up of him in the cage, and it's Baker.
Right, right.
And then later when the monkey runs amok, when Kong runs amok, he's like throwing stuff all over the place. And then they cut to a shot of the robot, and like one arm is lifting part of the cage. I swear to God, the robot's in the film for less than 30 seconds. Because I've read a blog post from someone who is an extra in that scene, and he was talking about the subterfuge, and you know, this is what they told the actors: the robot is in the entire film, but today he's not working very well. But I got to see it on a big screen. And one final thing about G-Fest.
Yes.
Our own Adam Riske and I specifically attended a panel about this year's Godzilla, trying to see what people who love Godzilla enough to attend a 3-day convention thought. And it was interesting, they had this panel of experts, these three guys, and they started by asking for a show of hands of what people thought. And the ballroom was full. I mean, there was maybe 200 people in there. Raise your hand if you thought it was excellent. And 75% of the people raised their hands.
Yeah.
So Godzilla fans love it because it's got Godzilla in it. Okay, raise your hand if you thought it was good. About 10 more percent. If you thought it was okay, maybe 10 more percent. And then if you really hate it, if you really thought it was poor, and about six of us raised our hands. And it was interesting because the three of them on the panel had clearly come to talk about their problems with Godzilla.
Mm.
And once they saw the way the wind blows, I wish I could have recorded it. It started out with them very eloquently and concisely stating their objections to the films,
mm-hmm.
many of which we voiced on this podcast.
Okay.
But as the hour went on, it was an hour of them backtracking and backpedaling and admitting things and finally like coming over. During the course of the hour, they completely changed their position.
And by the end, they liked it?
They were admitting how much they liked it in spite of these. And there were pretty serious objections. Like,
were they movie objections or were they Godzilla fan objections?
Both, but for the most part, they were movie objections.
Okay.
The human story in the foreground has no interest whatsoever once Bryan...
Cranston is no longer in the movie.
Bryan Cranston is zipped into his body bag. Again...
Spoilers.
That panel discussion in itself would have been an interesting podcast if we could have got permission, because they completely changed their position as the thing went on. And also, and I don't mean to be cruel, at the end there was a question and answer session where people raised their hands, and several of the people in attendance were clearly on the spectrum.
Okay.
Just
sure.
This is your one outing for the year,
right,
where mom and dad let you out of the house. It was disturbing.
But it's a convention that sort of caters to that. This is my obsession, you know? And I've been thinking about Godzilla a lot lately. I was thinking about writing an article, and now I probably won't because I'm going to talk about it here. But after seeing Dawn of the Planet of the Apes coming off of Snowpiercer, coming off of Edge of Tomorrow, I would include Godzilla, and I still didn't like the movie, but I would still include it in the category of sort of this summer blockbusters that we are lucky to have. Because again, I feel like it was a film made by a guy with a voice who made a lot of choices and tried to do something that he thought was different. Now, I didn't like the choices. I didn't like the movie. But it is not Transformers. It is not. I think there's a category of summer movie that is what we're used to getting, and that is everything that is broken in Hollywood.
Bland, predictable,
Spider-Man,
loud,
right.
Trash.
Maleficent, I would really put in that category. Transformers. I don't think Godzilla belongs in that category.
I would agree.
Even though I didn't like the movie. So I've just been thinking about it a lot lately. I'll go kind of quickly through mine because one of mine was Life Itself, and we talked about that. I watched all five, not all five. I didn't watch the original Planet of the Apes, but I watched the four sequels.
Well, you don't have to watch the original. You can just listen to our award-winning podcast.
And I think because I had watched it when we did that, I was like, well, I've seen it recently enough. I didn't watch the Burton one, and I didn't even have time to watch Rise of the Planet of the Apes before going into this one. But I watched all the sequels, and they're still great and a lot of fun. I liked Battle less than I remembered liking it, which is interesting because Dawn is kind of a remake of Battle. And it had been years since I watched all of them, sort of marathoned all of them. And so I remembered Conquest of the Planet of the Apes, which is sort of what Rise was a remake of. I don't know if the unrated version was on the DVD.
The unrated version of?
Conquest of the Planet of the Apes.
Oh, no, I know what you're talking about.
Was it on the DVD?
Yeah, it is.
I mean, I must have watched it. I don't know why I would have not chosen to watch the unrated version, but I didn't realize there was an unrated.
You tweeted about it.
Yeah.
As you were watching
it. So it comes on, and I was like, well, sure, I'll watch the... I just assumed it would be longer, not thinking unrated meant something in 71 or 72.
Oh, yeah.
Holy shit.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And I should have known, just because it's J. Lee Thompson, like, and he just loves to be trashy. It's like a Sam Peckinpah movie.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and the tweet that I remember is, will this torture scene ever end?
Erica was out and had just come home, and she was like, what are you watching? Because it's 5 minutes straight of Roddy McDowell screaming. And mostly I wrote that tweet just so I could hashtag monkey torture, which is a callback to a state sketch. I watched a couple of Walter Hill movies for an article that I'm publishing on the site this week. I watched The Long Riders, which I had never seen, which was good. I watched Brewster's Millions, which I had never seen.
I forgot he directed that.
You would never know it.
Oh, my God.
It's him trying to do what Landis did with Trading Places, but it's really not good. I saw Deadly Eyes for the first time, which is the 1982 Canadian killer rat movie, famous for the fact that they dressed up dachshunds in rat costumes to suggest their enormous size. So you have two versions of, you have the long shot, the wide shot from above, which is just a bunch of enormous rat backs running down an alleyway. And then you have the close-up shots where someone screams and a rat puppet head just tugs on their arm with some fake blood coming out. I had fun with it. I would not argue that it is a good movie, but it's coming out on Blu-ray from Scream Factory. And then the last thing I'll talk about is I finally saw Out of the Furnace, which was Scott Cooper's follow-up to Crazy Heart. Came out, I think, last year, and it just showed up on Netflix Instant, which is how I watched it. And the movie came out, made no money, got pretty bad reviews. And so I thought maybe that was affecting my reaction to it for a while, because for the first hour, almost hour and a half, I was pretty on board with the movie. It has some good actors, some good sort of a sense of place, and it was obvious that he was just trying to like turn a Springsteen song into a movie. Just, we're good. And then the last half hour was, I thought, terrible. The whole thing is pretty grim and overwrought and doesn't really arrive at anything. It never really comes together. So it was a big letdown to see that last half hour sort of solidify all of the bad reviews. I think they were pretty warranted.
I remember around us, it was in theaters for a week, And my son went to see it, and he actually liked it a lot.
Yeah. It's good for a while, and then I just think all the air kind of lets out of it. Anyway, so that's it. Let's talk Dawn of the Planet of the Apes.
Okay, what'd you think?
I thought it was great. You?
Yeah, so did I.
Thanks, guys, for listening.
For a number of reasons. For a number of reasons. And I think you can relate this to Snowpiercer as well. When did it happen in American films where there are movies where everything is so on the surface, it is impossible to think that the film is about anything else?
I would suggest it's been a gradual progression. I think it has only gotten worse in recent years and will only continue to get worse because of the importance of global box office. That yeah. Now things have to just be what they are because you're making movies for an audience that is not English speaking, that might not understand certain nuances, not of storytelling, but just even of American culture that, yeah. You know, might play into a film. So you're making movies that everything has to just be on the surface. This is what it is. So I couldn't, you know, necessarily pin it back to a specific moment, but I think it's just going to keep getting worse.
There's a wonderful book that I've recommended on the site before, and it's called A Certain Tendency of the Hollywood Cinema by Robert Ray. And he suggests that after World War II, the movie audience gets split into two groups. What he claims, and not pejoratively, what he says is the naive audience and the informed audience. And I think, by and large, the films that we tend to like here at F This Movie are films that will satisfy both audiences.
Yeah.
I think Dawn of the Planet of the Apes works as a rousing, almost boy's adventure tale. Very specifically a boy's adventure tale, if we have time to talk about that later on. But what I found most fascinating harkens back to the original Apes films that you were talking about. They were about so much more than this astronaut who winds up on this crazy ape planet.
Which, again, is what you can... Not to... Last week I was shitting on the Tim Burton remake of Willy Wonka, and now I can shit on the Tim Burton remake of Planet of the Apes. I know I didn't just rewatch it, but I remember knowing that that movie wasn't about anything. It was about an astronaut who landed on... It was about, oh, we can make great ape makeup now, and let's have the astronaut land on the crazy ape planet. And it was just sort of the adventure film, and a bad adventure film at that, but it lost all of the subtext, all of it, and had no characters to care about.
And the other thing that I compare it to is Anthony Burgess, who wrote... Clockwork Orange, used to review books, and he's got this little slim volume that I'd recommend. It's called 99 Novels, and he talks about what he feels are the 99 best novels published since World War II, and each book has a little essay attached to it, and that's the book. But in the introduction of the book, he brings up something called philosophical residue. Something that a true work of art leaves behind in your brain that you then carry with you, and you have that with you for the rest of your life. Dawn of the Planet of the Apes works as a rousing adventure film. The audience I saw it with applauded at the end. That doesn't happen very often. But if you're kind of a thinker, you can sit there, and I couldn't believe the range of things that Dawn of the Planet of the Apes might really be about. The nature of humankind.
Right.
Our fear. The fear that lies at the base of existence because life is not predictable and there's a certain amount of fear involved in that. And the things that fear causes us to do. Which is one of the things I like so much about Paranorman. When people are scared, you can get them to do practically everything. But then there's another level of it. That the film seems to be saying something about class and something about race.
Okay.
And specifically, I think something about guns.
Yes.
And that isn't even implicit.
Right.
That is very explicit.
Right. Things go bad when guns get involved. I'm kind of amazed. Not amazed. Here's the thing. I don't want to necessarily overpraise the movie because I'm really high on it right now. And I wonder if a little bit of that is just because I'm in apes mode and I just rewatched all of them. I think back to our Skyfall podcast, and I really liked Skyfall, but I probably was crazy about it because I was way in James Bond land at the time.
And that garage door goes up.
Exactly. So I was so hyped up on James Bond, and then here comes a good James Bond movie, and it's like, this is the best thing ever. And same with Planet of the Apes. I'm all watching all the Apes movies, and then here comes this Planet of the Apes movie that's really good, and it's like, oh, I want to be so excited about this. It's crazy to me. Again, we have to take a step back and appreciate the fact that, A, that this movie exists, and B, that it comes out in the summertime. This is not... It's being marketed as a summer blockbuster. It's wall-to-wall special effects because all the...
And speaking of marketing...
CGI.
I mentioned this, and I think you had said you hadn't seen it. There is a billboard for this film that's this beautiful oil painting of Caesar on a horse and the Golden Gate Bridge is behind him. Yeah. And it harkens back to the way they used to advertise movies in the 70s where it was just... Doesn't this look like something you'd want to see? And that there's no text and the... The billboard is great.
I just was sitting watching this movie thinking, how did they sneak this movie out into the summer? And so much of it should be terrible, again, because they remade Planet of the Apes once. It was, again, born out of cynicism, and the results reflected that. So then a few years ago, they're like, well, we're going to do a prequel, and it's, oh, Jesus, really? And it comes out, and it's better than I thought it would be.
And we were not the biggest fan
of
Rise.
Right. But it was better than I thought it was going to be.
Dawn is better than Rise.
Much better, yeah. I think. And that's not to say anything, you know, terrible about Rise. It was I liked it more than I thought I would. I appreciated the fact that some thought went into it, some care went into it. They weren't just trying to make a stupid Planet of the Apes prequel that connects all the dots. And here's how this happens. And here's how the Statue of Liberty got there. Like, oh, Jesus, I don't need that. And so now we've entered into this new sort of phase where they're not rebooting things necessarily. They're not just sequelizing them. They're not really prequels. It's like they're just making these new Planet of the Apes movies.
And the word has been thrown around and bastardized, and the usefulness of it has faded, but they are true reimagining.
Yeah.
Because I never thought that Rise was a remake of Conquest. I thought parts of Dawn seemed to be a lot like parts of Battle.
Yeah.
But one of the things I give this film credit for is the first 10 minutes is sort of Conquest in brief. This film accomplishes a lot of story between the James Franco chapter and this chapter very economically. And couldn't you have imagined the prologue of Dawn being its own shitty movie?
Oh, for sure.
Because that movie is World War Z with apes instead of zombies.
Right. We need to see how the world goes to shit. And they really made a smart choice by just skipping all of that. It's set up at the end of Rise and Dawn picks up after it's happened. We don't need to see that.
So clearly the people behind this and the people behind Rise, again, we're going to make this mistake all through the podcast. Give them different names. Have watched the original series and have taken some things away.
Yeah.
But they're not slavish. At no point do you see fan service.
No, there's none of those obnoxious.
There's a couple tiny little things where it's a tip of the hat. Maurice the orangutan is kind of a nice shout out. The name of Caesar's wife.
Okay.
But other than that, they don't insult.
Oh, it's Cornelia, right?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
Something I discovered, because I didn't want to stumble through another podcast and not get actors and characters' names wrong, is that besides Andy Serkis, who's sort of made a career out of these motion capture performances, and I wonder if we'll ever get to the day, not that the Oscars mean anything, that will be recognized. Because watching this, it made me wonder why he didn't get a Best Supporting Actor nomination for Smeagol. For Gollum, because that was something.
Yeah, I would argue this is better. I don't know, because I don't know how much.
But all the main apes were motion captured.
Yes, and
so
Toby Kebbell played Koba,
Koba,
and is amazing.
Judy Greer,
yeah,
played Cornelia.
Most of her stuff, I believe, got cut out.
Okay, yeah. That makes a lot of sense, yeah. Because there's a couple other things that seem to have hit the curb because they wanted a shorter running time.
Yeah.
There's one specific plot hole where you're like, anyway. Okay. So I just wonder if that'll ever happen. This film has some of the most amazing special effects I've ever seen.
Yeah.
I mean, talk about the state of the art in 2014. There's a couple close-ups of the apes, specifically one I'm thinking at the end, where a lot of care was taken to make it look so photorealistic. You get those sort of uncanny chills.
Yeah.
Because it just looks so...
Again, they've crossed over because the problem with a lot of the motion capture early on when Zemeckis was doing it was that the eyes were dead, the faces were sort of blank, and maybe it's because they're chimpanzees and not humans, but the faces on the apes, and particularly Caesar, and so much of the performance, which is why I feel like Andy Serkis is better here than as Gollum, even though Gollum is amazing, because so much of the performance is just in the face and in the eyes, and they've got that figured out because the eyes are amazing.
All I meant in terms of Lord of the Rings,
yeah,
because I'm not a particular fan of that series, but I remember seeing the first one, and the first time Gollum goes into one of those schizophrenic monologues,
yeah,
the audience was like, this is the creepiest
yeah.
thing I've ever seen, and that's what he brought to it with his voice.
Right.
Throughout Dawn, I kept thinking that Caesar's voice was being provided by James Remar.
Interesting.
It sounds exactly like James Remar.
It does, kind of, yeah.
And
I've seen a lot of lately because I was watching a lot of Walter Hill movies.
And I was surprised that Serkis pulled that off
yeah.
because that's unlike any of the voices he's ever done.
But the voice is great. Oh, man. All right, so I'm way too high on this movie. Wait, I was going to say something and now I forgot what. Let me throw out this one sort of criticism so that we don't sound like total hypocrites. And again, we're going to get into...
I have some quibbles.
Yeah, we'll get into spoilers in a couple of minutes.
Although you brought up Skyfall.
Yeah.
Looking back when I first got the 4K TV,
yeah.
It might have even been you that suggested this.
It was.
That it turned out to be beautiful material to show off what the TV looked like.
Yeah.
Because it's recent, blah, 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 blah. So I didn't have cable that month, so I wound up watching Skyfall about 5 times. I, too, was very high on James Bond because Skyfall was so much better than Quantum of Solace. I now have some quibbles against Skyfall, but
sure.
They're very slight, and one of them is a quibble I have against every movie made since 1995. It's a half an hour too long.
Skyfall is too long. I think I'm reacting to the fact that I think on the podcast I might have said I'd put Skyfall in my top 5 Bond, and I don't know that I would, although I don't know that I wouldn't.
I would.
Yeah.
Easily.
I don't know that I would, but I might. I've never actually sat down. I could do like 3 pretty confidently, but whatever. This is not a James Bond podcast. So we complained quite a bit on Godzilla about the human characters and how they were not particularly well developed. I think the same could be argued about Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. Having said that, I think they're developed as much as they need to be, and I don't think it's a problem the way that it was in Godzilla. Not to compare the two movies, but...
No. I want to compare them, because this might be a sliver-thin critical argument. But considering the absence of Godzilla...
This is where I was going.
In the film named Godzilla, they are sort of forcing us
right.
to pay attention to the foreground action. One thing you can say about Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, there's a lot of apes. There's big slabs of the film that don't have humans in it at all.
Which is great, but again, that's not what makes it a good movie. All I was going to say was... The humans were required to do most of the heavy lifting in Godzilla, and because they were so underdeveloped, the movie didn't work for me. Whereas apes, they are underdeveloped, but the apes carry the movie. You're not required to care about the humans as much as you need to, or as much as you do about the apes, even though, again, like I said, I think the humans are well-developed enough, and I think the screenplay is clever in the way that there are reflections of... the humans and the apes, that they all kind of mirror one another, that for every human character, there's an ape character. And without really beating you over the head with it, the conclusions are pretty easy to draw, but I thought it was clever in that way. So it ends up being kind of a non-criticism, right? I mean, it's Stuart saying like, well, the humans are a little underdeveloped, but it doesn't matter because I don't think it hurts the film.
True. And I think there were some attempts made to develop the human story. Not all of them succeed. I thought casting Jason Clarke was a really great idea because I think I've only seen him in this and Zero Dark.
Okay.
But it seems to me Jason Clarke is an actor who brings a lot to the party without having to have explicit dialogue about it.
Sure.
He's very good at portraying things wordlessly. And I thought he was one of the best things in this film. I think an attempt is made to not make Gary Oldham the standard stock because the trailer made me think, he's the lunatic.
Human wants to kill all the apes.
Kill them all. That there is some attempt made to make him three-dimensional.
And I think that's true of all of the movie's villains, if you will.
Right. And I would argue that they're even more successful in portraying Koba because it's at this point that my brain that doesn't stop working when I go to the movies thinks this film has a lot to say about torture.
Yeah.
And what you get when you torture people.
Right.
And I thought that was... It spoke very eloquently to a zeitgeist that's still floating around this country, perhaps from the past. I thought it was interesting that, and I don't remember the character's name, the asshole.
Okay.
In fact, one of his lines is, "Oh, I'm the asshole." And I thought that was interesting because it reminded me of Tom Hulce in Fearless, who plays an asshole.
Okay.
And keeps telling everyone, "I know, I'm the worst." And he thinks that absolves him.
Right.
That as long as you identify yourself as the asshole, you absolve yourself of the responsibility of taking steps to not be an asshole.
His name's Carver, by the way, the character's name.
But I really thought Cody Smit-McPhee.
McPhee, yeah.
Was sort of underutilized except to show that they both had family.
Right.
He's certainly gotten taller since Let Me In.
Yeah.
And I really thought Kerry Russell was underserved. I didn't agree with most of what was in Dana Stevens' review, but Stevens brings up that this is very much a boys' adventure film because she thought it was sort of disturbing that the film seemed to be saying women exist to have babies, to stay behind, and to care for us when we get sick. That the view of females in this film is really retrograde.
That's valid. It is a movie played out by men, you know, or male characters who make the decisions and fight the fights. And that's absolutely valid. Kerry Russell, I thought, was... Again, served the material fine, but wasn't given anything to do. And I agree that Jason Clarke gave a better performance than, I think, what was written. But I don't feel like any of the human characters, again, I'm spending too much time on this one. I don't think hurts the movie. Everybody kind of just has the one note that they play. Even Jason Clarke basically has the one note that he plays the whole time, which is like, good guy wants to get along with apes. Okay, great. And he does a good job of it, but all of the humans are just kind of the one thing. And ironically enough, it's the apes who are all three-dimensional.
And that's ultimately why I thought that quibble didn't spoil it for me, because this film is so interested in showing us apes.
That's who it's about.
And that the apes are in the foreground.
Yeah.
I could excuse the cardboard characters in Godzilla if I was... if my attention was being focused more on Godzilla.
Yeah. Do we need to get into spoilers now, or do you have more without spoilers?
You know, are we conveying how much people should go see it?
I hope so. I mean, I feel like people are kind of going to see it. I certainly hope. I know it's had a successful weekend. It is a better, smarter movie than we usually get in the summer, and I feel like we've had a few of those lately. And aren't we lucky? You know, again, if not for all the special effects and the title that this is, you know, part of a larger franchise, And the fact that there is some fighting, although I don't even think there's as much sort of action or adventure as there traditionally is in,
oddly enough,
in a summer movie.
I've read several things on the internet that people are cautioning people who haven't seen it yet that it's very violent.
Okay. I didn't think it was... I mean, it's intense, and I think that's what they're responding to more than actual bloodshed
on
screen.
And we're in spoilers now.
Let's get into spoilers. So go see it, please, if you haven't already. It's
my
evidence really, really good.
That this film isn't nearly as violent as it could have been.
Yeah.
Is there is a scene where the apes that are loyal to Caesar are being held in a bus.
Yeah.
And at one point they stage a breakout by grabbing through the windows at apes outside the bus and strangling them and then throwing all their weight against the side of the bus so that the apes who are pinned against the bus get crushed by the bus.
Right.
I was getting ready to look away from the screen at what the money shot of that sequence might have been, but it's positively tame.
Yeah.
It is not gruesome at all.
I think I wonder if the people that are responding to the violence are responding more to sort of the intensity of the film instead of what's actually on screen. And there is certainly violence. A lot of mostly ape characters die in the last act of the film as people are sort of slaughtered wholesale. But I thought there was less, again, action, fewer action set pieces than we're traditionally used to in a summer movie. And I wonder if some people will go to this movie and feel let down because it's mostly kind of a character drama that looks and kind of feels a little bit like a summer blockbuster, but isn't.
One thing people are not going to say is there weren't enough apes.
No, they will not be saying that.
And another quibble, and this is the only other quibble that I have with the film, is I think it resorts one too many times to you get shot, but you're not dead.
Okay. Ash, it happens to Ash, it happens to Caesar, obviously.
Right. I think that was one too many.
Okay. I mean, I wasn't positive that Caesar was going to be alive when they killed him off about two-thirds of the way. I assumed he was dead.
And then I began to think, because it seems to me they have, what's that expression, that they're looking down the road and that there will be another one.
Yeah.
I began to wonder what the series would be like without Caesar.
Right.
Or if Blue Eyes...
Right.
Here's a prediction.
Okay.
I may be wrong, and I'm thinking that Patrick is going to roll his eyes and pray that they don't do this. Yeah. In Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, Caesar and Cornelia have a baby.
Right.
It's a little chimp, cute as a button, and they don't name it yet.
Okay.
I thought they were going to use that in the next movie as a dun-dun-dun, that it would have some... It would have, what if they named the baby Cornelius?
Yeah, I was halfway expecting that in this movie, and again, very relieved that it doesn't play that game, because I'm not interested in them
tying it.
I'm not interested in this being tied to the original series. It has very much carved out an identity as its own thing, and should remain such.
And again, in terms of analogy, what can be more appropriate for the world in which we're living, that what we now have is a series of films about how two very different groups, how can they get along?
Right.
And I think that's not only something I'm interested in seeing, but I think we should be interested in seeing the way that's worked out in art.
I halfway expect that people will start referring to this movie as the Empire Strikes Back of the series, because that's what we always call... the sort of darker, more thoughtful installment, especially one like this, that sort of, it tells a complete story. It's not half a movie, but it does end on not a cliffhanger, but
clearly
it doesn't totally resolve. He says, nope, war is coming. And it's our fault, which I thought was so interesting. And I feel like my theater kind of wanted to applaud. There was a smattering here and there, and then people were like, oh, we're not doing this. And then no one applauded. But part of that, I feel like, is it's our natural response when a movie sticks the landing.
Yeah.
And the way that this movie closes with that speech, and then it pushes in the same way it opened, just on Caesar's eyes.
It's a great last shot.
And you're just like, holy shit. And you want to applaud just, oh, this was something. This was an achievement.
And I want to applaud because I didn't get ripped off.
Yeah, right.
I gave you money,
yeah,
and you gave me something in return.
I got to give so much credit to Matt Reeves, who could have, I just feel like, could have made a very different movie.
It would have been very easy for this movie to be lazy.
Yeah, again, and because I think they have a brand already.
I think some people are going to accuse it of being lazy. I disagree.
Okay.
But in terms of the humans not being as well developed as the apes, that could be their evidence for laziness.
But that's just a complaint that, like, hey, I'm a human and I want to see us be better realized on screen, because the movie is not lacking for three-dimensional characters.
They just aren't
the humans. But the humans are the supporting characters. They are not the leads of this movie.
And clearly inferior in some ways. One thing my wife mentioned right before I left to come here to do the podcast, my lovely wife thinks the film is also saying something interesting about colonialism.
Okay.
Because when the human characters want to fix the dam, they give nothing to the apes in exchange for that.
Yeah.
We want this.
Right.
And, right? And the apes concede and allow them to. And when that thing caves in, the apes are willing to help them. Also, this is a very minor note, but it's one of the smaller pleasures of the film. That little system of dollies that they have to ride to get through the tunnel reminded me of the movie The Great Escape. And I thought that was just a nice... They could have had a cave where they had to walk through the cave and then all the rocks. But that little visual touch is so much more interesting. And also throughout the film, we're reminded of how strong the apes are.
Yeah,
which I think is interesting. And again, I had a shout out to this when you introduced me at the beginning. The line that my wife and I were discussing this morning was when the humans are saying about the apes, the scariest thing is they don't need electricity or lights. And again, if you want to see this film as a class parable, the lower class, which the humans clearly think the apes, I mean, Gary Oldham ends up screaming, they're animals.
Right.
The lower class, the strata of society that everyone looks down on, they have nothing to lose.
Right.
And that should be terrifying to people who have a lot to lose. So again, it is rare in a summer blockbuster that we're given anything to chew over. And one of the things I really love about Dawn of the Planet of the Apes and Snowpiercer is there's a lot to chew on.
Right.
And I don't think that's asking too much.
No, it's not. And I wonder if maybe now movies that offer that end up getting overly praised because the alternative is nothing. I mean, nothing. And maybe that's the case. I don't know. I thought it was interesting that your comment about colonialism and how the humans offer nothing. At the same time, like, Caesar's absolutely right when he says, if we don't do this, if we don't let them, they'll just come kill us. Because that's their plan. We've already heard Gary Oldman say,
yes,
either they let us do it or we're going to come kill them. So it's almost this implicit threat.
But Caesar's original solution, if you will, is a solution that a lot of intelligent people have suggested. We're going to stay here.
Right.
And you stay here.
Right.
And that will be the peace.
Right.
In the real world, I don't think that ever works.
Well, and the movie makes that case.
I don't think that ever works. But you can see someone, just like someone who watches Snowpiercer and agrees with Ed Harris, that someone could sit there in the movie with that personal ideology and say, if they had just stuck to their territory, everything would have been fine.
And to an extent, that's true. But again, we needed the dam because we needed the power, because we can't survive the way that the apes can.
Which is another wonderful moment that I wanted to discuss if you're willing to discuss this.
Of course.
When they get the electricity going again,
yeah.
I don't think it was accidental that the first thing we see is a gas station light up with the Union 76 ball, and one of the humans gets some music going on the PA. I think they chose The Wait by the band later in the post-production process, because when they show the guy dancing, The Wait is not really a song that you would dance to.
I guess, but if it's the first music you've heard in years, then
clearly. But there were
dance
two,
to anything.
There were two things I thought were odd and wonderful about that scene. Number one, when the lights go on and the music plays, The humans in the scene, it's like a drug.
Oh yeah,
it's like Soma.
Yeah.
Oh
yeah,
this is with lights and music.
Right. We're normal again.
And one thing that I wished, because Caesar's in that scene, He's on a horse. Caesar has a reaction to the music that I couldn't quite figure out. And I wish they had explored that. Caesar was raised by the James Franco character. Clearly, Caesar knows what music is. Do the apes have a different reaction to that? He seems to look quizzically at the guy who's dancing. But I just wish they had explored that. It wouldn't have taken very long, because one of the things the film is about how we're the same and how we're different.
Right.
So I thought that was a lost opportunity. One thing I loved, before I forget, when Koba goes back to the human compound, you know what I'm talking about?
I wanted to talk about this scene.
Man, it speaks to so many things.
Yeah.
The humans are afraid of him because he's terrifying to look at.
Right.
But he remembers from his days back in the cage that it's really easy to make humans react by just acting like an ass.
And it's this idea of...
He's this clownish performing monkey.
And fitting into a box like, oh, this is what you need me to be. This is what makes you comfortable, as long as you think I'm this thing.
And if we accept that one of the things the film is talking about is race, it's that yeser master shucking and jiving that we got used to at a certain point in history. But I thought that scene was so clever and so well performed.
Yeah, another great instance of...
Considering that it's wordless.
Motion capture acting.
Except for the two idiots who are now comfortable because the monkey wants to drink some whiskey. That we're okay with the monkey wanting some whiskey and making faces.
But and yet it's true of us even in the audience when he reverts back to that as a show. That's what we are used to. No, I mean, not the drinking whiskey, but even the way his face changes, he becomes the chimpanzee that we're used to in pop culture, in the zoo, whatever.
But I actually thought that was one of the scariest scenes in the film.
Yeah.
And
well, because you know what's coming,
and
too.
Very well observed. And also, again, so much more than we're used to getting in a summer popcorn movie.
And in just one little scene. It's this one little scene that tells this one story and has this bigger idea that fits into a larger framework of movies of scenes like that with bigger ideas. And again, you just have to appreciate a filmmaker who puts so much care into making something really good instead of just making something with a recognizable IP.
I like ideas.
Me too, and apes. I read Caesar's reaction, or the reaction of all the apes, to the music as more of that kind of, we don't need, like, this is what you guys needed? Like, this is what's going to change everything? Okay, you know, almost...
You risked your life.
A little bit of contempt, or confusion at, like, so this is what it's for? I don't know. How did you feel about I Thought of You... At the end of the movie.
When I saw all those apes, especially the orangutan, I thought of you.
The one that wanted the booze. No, Maurice, I think, is the most photorealistic. I mean, there were so many shots of Maurice where I was not sure I was looking at a CGI ape. Caesar is great, gives a great performance, but I could always tell was a special effect. Koba maybe a little bit less so, but Maurice, I really thought, was a real orangutan.
And it's a little on the nose, and it's a little treacly, but I gotta say, maybe as an English teacher, the scene where they share the book,
yeah,
I thought that was delightful.
So we get to the end of the movie, and it's the big fight on the tower as things are crashing down, and it's two CGI creations beating one another up. And I thought of you because you've often lamented that trope at the end of movies like this.
And that's my least favorite part of the film, when everything's crashing down and
it's got to end with some excitement.
And they're both swinging on a chain. It reminded me of the scene in Peter Jackson's King Kong, where it's not enough that he fights dinosaurs, but that they have to fall through vines, and it becomes a video game.
Yeah.
Where I would give Reeves credit is it's mercifully brief.
Sure.
But again, another quibble that I would make with the film is that people recover very quickly.
Okay.
And maybe that's because we only have 2 hours.
Yeah.
But both Caesar, who's recovering from a very serious shotgun wound, and Koba fall incredible distances. And that's that Van Helsing effect where if you're just going to get slammed around, it has no weight.
Right.
That being said, Caesar's eventual decision, I thought had tremendous weight as a moral choice. The film was clearly presenting this as a moral choice that would define the rest of his life.
Right.
And again, when in summer blockbusters do we get that? The scene earlier when he's on James Franco's couch and he says something like, I made a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
I trusted him because he was an ape.
Yeah.
I thought we were getting very close to Martin Luther King. When are we going to judge people by the content of their character instead of the color of their skin? And that, of course, is something we need more of in popular entertainment.
And I thought it was interesting, too, the way the movie resolves with that conversation between him and Jason Clarke, which is basically like, well, we tried, and it didn't work. And again, the acknowledgement that war is started because apes started it, and now I have to live with that, and you guys got to scram and be safe.
And clearly we sympathize with Caesar and with Malcolm. And one of the things I kept thinking throughout the first hour of the film, I don't know if you were thinking this or if it was just a natural thing to think, we naturally sympathize with those two characters and think they're right.
Mm-hmm.
And I kept thinking, if it just wasn't for shitty, stupid people, things would be so much better.
And yet again, I think the movie is smart about giving everyone a point of view that it is consistent with and honest about, that Gary Oldman is not a cartoon villain who wants to kill all the apes because we're humans and we're better. And that even Carver, the asshole, is really just bearing a lot of resentment because he blames the apes for the sickness that wiped everyone out, even though, you know, people say, no, that's not true, but he can't get past that idea.
Which we certainly see in our society today.
And that Koba is still angry and hurting from being tortured and the way he was treated by humans, that he's right to be suspicious of them, that he doesn't trust them, that it's not just, hey, I want to be in charge because I have a fantasy of being the leader.
That's not what it's about. I thought that was the part that was best developed, both in the script and in the performance. I completely understand why he's
right. That everyone has a motivation that you can sort of agree with, or you could at least see their side.
And also the belief
that never happens in movies,
that if you've been kept in a cage, the first thing you're going to do when you're put in a position of power is to put other people in a cage.
How do you like it, assholes? Yeah. But that idea of how everybody has they kind of have a point is also, I think, true of Snowpiercer.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. I was having a conversation. I shan't spoil it.
No.
But I was having a conversation with Risky at G-Fest about Snowpiercer, because God knows we couldn't talk about Godzilla. And he actually solidified a belief I had about the end of the film, because at the end of Snowpiercer, I said I could see a lot of people thinking that they agree with another character in the film in terms of the film's inevitable conclusion. I won't spoil it. And Risky said that in spades.
I was very nervous that they were going to do a callback when Koba's hanging from the thing and Caesar's deciding whether or not to let him go. I thought we were going to get a really cheesy ass callback to we had seen it twice before, where Koba kind of gets down on his knees, Caesar puts out his hand, he touches it, and that means, okay, we're cool, and he walks away.
Submission.
That it was going to be that thing again, where he puts his hand out, and you know what I mean? Like, but that's how he gets dropped, and I was really dreading that moment. And again, credit to the filmmakers for not doing something stupid.
I thought the sign language of the apes was very well worked out.
Yeah.
And you can tell that someone spent some time coming up with a viable language to the point where when they do speak, you can tell how unnatural it is for them.
Yeah.
And how
it doesn't come easily. And the formation of the words isn't always, I mean, it's really, really well done.
Yeah. And Caesar's the best at it, of course.
Right. There's just so many things this movie has going for it. And it's really an accomplishment, not just as a really good movie, but again, if you take it within the context of sort of where we are at with $100 million to $200 million studio movies, this breaks so many of the trends and gives us so much credit as an audience for being smart, for being thoughtful, for having a compassion to care about characters and people, even if they are apes. That's the stupidest thing I've ever said. You know, people, but apes. That it does so many of those things well. And it was a movie that ended, and I felt lucky to have it.
And you can certainly say the money's on the screen.
Yeah.
Because it is a very large canvas with a lot of characters. But also, not just that we're invested in the drama, but I think, and maybe we tend to see this more in terms of literature, that the purpose of art is to let us work out these things in a fanciful way and take away something that maybe will affect the way that we lead our lives or the way that we choose to behave.
I had recommended this movie to Erica, which I would normally never do because she's not necessarily interested in the franchise. I don't even know if she's, except for the Burton one, I don't know that she's ever seen a Planet of the Apes movie and probably just doesn't have much interest. But we saw this movie on the same weekend as the Ebert documentary, and that Ebert makes the point in the movie, and which I think Adam brought up in his review, that Ebert calls movies machines to generate empathy. And I had recommended this movie to Erica because I feel like that's one of the things this movie does really well. And even though she doesn't care about science fiction or Planet of the Apes, that I knew that she would like the movie because of the way that it generates empathy for characters that didn't exist without computers.
And at the same time, is a rousing adventure tale. Both sides of the coin.
Yeah. Thanks, everybody, for listening. We will talk to you next week. I don't know what the show is yet. We'll figure it out. But thanks, JB.